today. Inquiries across the world have shown that child sexual abuse in the Catholic Church has been rife. The Pope has called a summit at the Vatican in February, but is it too little, too late? And in analysis, Venezuela is facing turmoil after politician Juan Guaido mounted an unprecedented challenge to the president, Nicolas Maduro. Our Latin American correspondent tells us how the country has been thrown into uncertainty. In February, bishops from around the world will attend a summit at the Vatican to tackle child abuse within the Catholic Church.
The February meeting on the protection of minors has a concrete purpose. The goal is that all of the bishops clearly understand what they need to do to prevent and combat the worldwide problem of the sexual abuse of minors.
For Pope Francis, it is crucial that this goes well.
An explosive report alleging a cover-up of Catholic priest sex abuses dating back decades.
Last year, investigations around the world showed that historical sex abuse had been covered up for decades, and thousands of victims gave evidence of rape and abuse.
1,670 members of the Catholic clergy here in Germany.
Hearings have begun in Australia into allegations of widespread child sex abuse in the Catholic Church.
And here in the UK, part of the National Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse is focusing on the Catholic Church. People have shared what happened to them in the hope that doing so will stop it happening to others and give them some sort of closure.
This is a public inquiry, so the British public, they've got to know about this. They'll please get behind us and stop this evilness happening again.
And this is like an iceberg, we don't know what's under the water, but it's also like a snowball. It's just growing and growing, and I don't know when we're going to get to the end of it.
From The Guardian, I'm India Rakesson. Today in Focus, can the Catholic Church ever begin to heal the damage of the past, for itself and for thousands of victims? You should know that people in this podcast share stories of rape and abuse that some listeners may find upsetting. Why has this inquiry been started?
Well, it's been started because the scale of abuse in the Catholic Church is absolutely enormous, not just in the UK, but across the globe.
Harriet Sherwood is The Guardian's religious affairs correspondent.
There's 13 strands of the inquiry, and there's two of those strands concern the Catholic Church and the Church of England.
The inquiry that Harriet's talking about is the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse in the UK. It's examining stories of abuse across different institutions in the country. It began in the wake of the Jimmy Savile scandal.
The evidence is now overwhelming that one of Britain's most beloved entertainers, the late Sir Jimmy Savile, was also a predatory sex offender.
And it was launched by then Home Secretary Theresa May in 2014.
That the government will establish an independent inquiry panel of experts in the law and child protection to consider whether public bodies and other non-state institutions have taken seriously their duty of care to protect children from sexual abuse.
It's a massive thing. It's going to go on for years. It's going to produce lots of reports. Some reports have come out already. There's ongoing hearings all the time. It's a very, very big thing. And of course, both the Church of England and the Catholic Church are taking a really central role in it.
What did you make of it when you heard that this inquiry was happening and that it was going to look into the Catholic Church?
I thought it was a good thing. I think it's important that the scale of abuse is really examined closely and that lessons are learned. And of course, it's not just the abuse that's taken place over decades, but it's really the role of the church in covering up that abuse and protecting its reputation. And I think that's really what the inquiry is focusing a lot on, and it is not just the actions of predatory priests, but their superiors in many cases, bishops and so on, who hid criminal events, who moved priests to other jobs, moved them out of the country sometimes, took all sorts of measures, burned documents in order for this not to be revealed in the public eye.
The inquiry has been examining allegations of abuse at institutions run by the Archdiocese of Birmingham, which is the largest in the UK. This includes looking at schools, churches, children's homes, and scout groups. Last year, I met two men taking part in a five-day hearing to establish what happened in these places many decades ago. What's your friendship like now for you two?
It's good.
We've ended up good pals, actually. But I'm glad I got David by my side. He's a good man.
The voice you've just heard belongs to a man we'll call Tom, and you'll hear from his friend David. That's also not his real name. We're protecting their identities because they were abused for years in a school called St Joseph's, which is now a National Trust property known as Croom Court.
Yeah, it was 49 years ago at that school. I can't remember him, but he remembers me. I phoned him about 2 years ago through I got a contact off the internet.
Tom contacted David when he heard about the inquiry, suspecting that he too might have suffered abuse at the school.
I told him, let's fight this. Let them not get away with it. We'll stand together and we'll bring them to court. Let the British public find out what kind of animals and evil people these people were and what they've done to us. And we've become good friends since 18 months. He's my wee soul buddy at the minute.
Soul buddy?
Yeah.
When I met them, they had sat through 4 days of hearings. They were tired and shaken.
The brutality that was going on in that school, he was always running away, as was I. I was always running away. There was people getting brought back to that place by their social workers in cars and jumping out of moving cars so they didn't have to go back there. That's how bad that place was. Children jumping out of moving cars.
The school described itself as a school for disadvantaged boys. And it was here that David says he experienced sexual abuse, and both he and Tom tell of physical abuse at the hands of nuns and a male member of staff.
My testimony is it's really powerful. At the age of 10 and a half, the reason why I left Croom Court, well, the beatings were tremendous. You were locked in covers, you were stripped naked, you public beatings were every day. It was everyday occurrence. You woke up in the morning, you were terrified to the last minute you went to bed. The nuns were evil. It was a school for feeble-minded children. When I was sent there...
Feeble-minded children?
Yeah, I was classed as severely retarded by the educational authority because I had a Glaswegian accent and I was playing truant. So that was enough to make me... seem to be severely retarded. I've got all the reports.
David, did you talk much about what happened to you at Croom Court?
No. The only person that knew was my psychologist, and it took me 45 years to tell her. And she was the only person. I told the Mother Superior what happened to me, and I got the life beaten out of me and told I was going to rot in purgatory for telling lies in front of the whole school. I got beaten black and blue. Black and blue. 5 days after that beating, we had a 2 week holiday, and I didn't go home on that holiday because of I was blue, purple, green, black all over my poor little bum. Unbelievable. And they wrote to my mum and dad and turned around and said that I'd been naughty, and for a punishment I wasn't going home for the 2 weeks. I'm still suffering today, 48, 49 years later. I'm still suffering. My head screwed up, nightmares, post-traumatic stress disorder, I've got depression. I'm not a man. My head is just smashed to pieces.
I know about the Catholic Church and how they work.
After Tom left Croom Court, he was sent to two other schools in the area run by the Catholic Church, where he says he was abused again. In recent years, arrests relating to abuse in these schools have been made. One man has been charged.
So everywhere I went, there was this paedophile, this old Catholic priest, Christian brothers, nuns. The place is rife.
The inquiry doesn't have the power to convict abusers, but Tom and David see this as their first chance to make sure their story is heard and for their testimony to make a difference. For both of them, it's been much harder than they thought.
Paragraph 42 on the following page.
The first time I was sexually abused was 6 to 9 months into my time at Croom Court. I was under 13 years old at the time.
When they read my statement, I just lost it. I was reliving my past from a little boy. And I lost it. Whenever we were in the
minivan, F262 said to me that I must not tell anyone or I would never play for the football team ever again.
I was reliving it. What happened to me that day, I relived it in that room. And I just lost it, and I cried my eyes out. I cried my eyes out, and I had to go. I can't do it, you know.
No one has ever been charged for abuse at Croom Court. More than 4 years ago, Tom told the Catholic Church's Child Protection Services about the abuse he experienced. The Archbishop of Birmingham wrote to him.
He sent me a letter to say, I'll say a prayer for you. No such thing as an investigation, no such thing as an apology. He wrote me, he gave me a postcard with a prayer on it and a private letter. Said, I hope everything in the future turns out right for you.
I asked Tom and David if an apology from Cardinal Vincent Nichols, who's the head of the Catholic Church in England and Wales, would make a difference to them now.
Well, if his apology can sort my head out, I'll accept it.
Yeah, I don't want their apology. No way I'm going to have an apology.
In December, we went with David to hear the church explain why abuse in schools like his was covered up for so long. The head of the Catholic Church in England and Wales, Cardinal Vincent Nichols, was being questioned by the inquiry about how he and others in the church had responded to historical allegations of abuse whilst he was Archbishop of Birmingham from 2002 to 2009.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Alexis.
It was the first time the head of the church had given evidence under oath.
Archbishop, your full name, please, for the inquiry.
My name is Vincent Gerard Nichols.
You were the former...
The room was full, mostly with solicitors, but also a dozen or so members of the clergy, watching closely from the sidelines. We sat with David and other survivors behind Nichols and listened to what he had to say.
The abuse of children in the context of a church, in the context of faith, is such a terrible, terrible thing. It is indeed something that breaks my heart and will forever mark my ministry as a priest.
For 3 hours, the Cardinal was questioned. He was asked about multiple cover-ups and why more hadn't been done in the church to safeguard against abuse. He talked about his time as the Archbishop of Birmingham and his work at the head of the church's internal safeguarding board, then called the Catholic Office for the Protection of Children and Vulnerable Adults, or COPCA. He highlighted the progress that had been made during his tenure and the amount of training that was undertaken to safeguard against further abuse.
Do you think there was other training you would have liked to have had?
We were very busy at the time. I don't think uppermost in my mind was a desire for more. I think I was just about coping with what we were doing and the progress we were trying to make in a very new area on very short timescales.
David and other survivors in the room seemed unconvinced by his response. At the end of his testimony, the Cardinal offered a full apology to survivors for the church's past failings and said they would be able to meet with individual bishops from the relevant diocese. In the closing statements at the inquiry, one of the solicitors representing survivors still felt the Cardinal had not done enough during his time as Archbishop of Birmingham.
And what we say is that Cardinal Nichols' actions as Archbishop of Birmingham are properly characterised as see as little evil as possible, hear as little evil as possible, speak as little evil as possible. He did no more than events forced him to do.
After the hearing, David met with the current Archbishop of Birmingham.
What did he say to you?
He said to me he's sorry for what happened and that he believes me. I said, I don't care whether you're sorry. I just care that you believe me. Your apology's nothing to me.
Do you think he understood that? Do you think he sort of got even a slice of what that experience is like for you?
He seemed to be sitting there listening, and but do you know how many times has a priest sat down there and apologised to someone for doing it, and it's still going on?
Do you think the process of sharing your story to the inquiry has been a good process?
Yeah, because now my story's out there and stories of other people. It's just like I said to you before, it's just people who listen to this. I just hope there's someone out there who's powerful and has got some influence that can turn around and do something about it. I just wish that I could have had a better life, but okay, sirrah, sirrah.
Thank you so much for talking to us. Harriet, David told us that he wants his testimony to have made a difference. What change is happening in the Catholic Church?
I think things have changed a lot in the last few years. And I think both the Church of England and the Catholic Church really do have a much greater understanding of abuse and the impact of abuse on people than they used to. I think for lots of survivors, it's not enough. They want more. I mean, for lots of survivors, this is their abuse has blighted their whole lives. But I think there have been improvements. I mean, I don't think we should say that the situation is as bleak as it was. We're moving forward. It's very, very slow, the progress. And survivors say it's too little, too late.
And we're still hearing, even now, that priests are resistant to having criminal record checks, which is just a very basic thing that you have to do when you work with children in this country.
Yes, it's very surprising when you look at it from outside the church. From inside the church, I assume those priests believe that their word should be good enough. You know, the surface hasn't even been broken. And who knows what's going on. And that's why I think it's really worrying for the church. And that is an explanation, one explanation, of why people aren't going to church anymore. Churches are in catastrophic decline. And one of the reasons for that is the legacy of child sexual abuse and the cover-up by the institutions themselves.
Harriet, you mentioned the church is in decline, but is that the case everywhere?
No, it's not. It's in decline in Western Europe and North America, but there are big swathes of the world where it's growing and growing very rapidly, and they're principally Asia and sub-Saharan Africa. And one of the interesting things in relation to abuse is that we have heard very little about abuse in those parts of the world. Lots of people fear it's happening, but we just haven't been told about it. There haven't been the kinds of inquiries and investigations that we've seen in Europe and in North America. And so people are worried that it's the tip of the iceberg.
Why haven't there been those investigations?
Because those countries aren't really in a position to launch big judicial investigations. It's not seen as such a big problem culturally.
So tell us what's happening at the Vatican in February.
The Vatican has organised a very big summit for the end of February. It's invited senior bishops, the presidents of bishops' conferences from all around the world. So there's going to be possibly 130 senior bishops there. They've also invited survivors to come to the summit, and they've told all the bishops who will be attending to meet survivors in their own countries. It's going to be over 4 days, and there is a huge amount of expectation that this could be a turning point for the church. The really key issue is whether Pope Francis will lay down the law to bishops, and that's what survivors will be watching for.
Do you think that much can be achieved from this summit?
I think that depends on Pope Francis. I think he could be very strong in what he says to the bishops. I think that if all he does is talk about the failures of the past and the shame of the church, I think it will enrage survivors. But I think he does have the potential to be much tougher than he has been before. I mean, in fact, before Christmas, he made a speech. Just before Christmas, he made a very powerful speech where he was extremely tough, and he talked about the church will never again cover up abuse and that it will spare no effort to bring perpetrators to justice. And he said people who abuse must turn themselves over to human justice but prepare for divine justice. And it was a strong speech, and it was applauded by lots of people, but survivors said, as they say repeatedly, we don't need more words, we need action.
Do you think the church can survive this in the West?
I spoke to a priest in Pennsylvania. I asked him that question. He was very progressive and young and really got it. And he said that he'd seen a fall off of the number of people coming into the church. He said he'd been really shocked by people perhaps thinking that he was an abuser. And when I asked him, can the church survive this? He said, it mustn't survive in its present form. It needs to be transformed.
Harriet, thank you very much. You can read all of Harriet Sherwood's work at theguardian.com. If you've been affected by any of the issues raised, or you're worried that a child you know may be at risk of abuse, you can contact the National Association for People Abused in Childhood at napac.org.uk or the National Society for the Protection of Cruelty to Children at nspcc.org.uk. Next, the majority of people living in Venezuela live in poverty, and the country is in economic turmoil. But this week, after 20 years of socialist rule, a call for change has come loud and clear from the streets of the capital.
In today's non-stop world, making quality time for yourself is more important than ever. When you buy a subscription to The Guardian and The Observer, you can look forward to sitting back and leafing through every page at your own pace. From the latest groundbreaking investigations to recipes, reviews, award-winning sports coverage, and more. Subscribe before the 3rd of February and you'll save up to 52% on newspaper subscriptions for a year. Just search Guardian Subscriptions.
Now, on Wednesday, a young politician, Juan Guaido, stood in front of thousands of protesters and declared himself interim president of Venezuela, challenging nearly 6 years of leadership from President Nicolas Maduro. On Thursday, Latin American correspondent Tom Phillips spoke to us as events continued to unfold.
So this morning you have a situation where Venezuela in effect has two presidents. One of them, Maduro, is recognised by countries such as China, Russia, Syria and Turkey. And the other, Juan Guaido, is recognised by the US, Brazil, Colombia, Argentina and many other Latin American countries. We just don't know how this is going to work at the moment. We don't know where Guaido is going to set up his parallel government. We don't know how, crucially, Maduro is going to react. We've seen some level of repression so far against protesters. All of this has happened incredibly fast. Juan Guaido is a 35-year-old politician, and he only took over as the head of the National Assembly, which is led by the opposition, at the beginning of January. So in less than 20 days, you've seen him go from relatively unknown opposition politician to being the guy now recognised as the leader of one of South America's most important countries by some of the most important governments on earth. So Maduro took over in 2013 from Hugo Chavez and describes himself as an heir to Chavez and someone who wants to carry on the social legacy and be a crusader for Venezuela's poor. In reality, in the last 5 years, he's led the country into an absolute economic catastrophe. I travelled through Venezuela towards the end of last year. It's really, really hard to describe the level of need. Many of the houses you walk into don't have water. Most of the people you meet don't have enough to eat. So the country is really in a dire situation. And now we're in a position where many, many people are hopeful of some kind of change. But there is also a huge sense of uncertainty. People just do not know what is going to come next. So we knew the protests were coming, and there was talk that he would make this very bold move and declare himself interim president. But even so, when Guaido did take to the stage and do that on Wednesday, it was a hell of a moment. I mean, a hugely dramatic moment.
Hoy 23 enero de 2019, ante Dios.
And after you know, 20 years of Chavista rule, the stars have, in a certain sense, aligned to allow Guaido to do this.
Juro
after years in which Latin America was largely governed by left-wing governments, you have a real conservative wave now sweeping across the region, most recently with Jair Bolsonaro, the far right, firebrand, being elected Brazil's president. And you also have right-wing leaders in Colombia and Argentina. And of course, you have Donald Trump in the White House. They are obviously ideologically opposed to Maduro and his project and want him gone. People want something new. They don't know too much about Juan Guaido, but he seems like a possibility of change. And I think many people are very aware that the path ahead is fraught with danger, even of potential conflict, bloodshed. But they see this is the one option in front of them now, and they just want to grab it with both hands. The one thing Guaido is lacking at the moment is support from the armed forces, and that is really what he needs if he is going to take this to the next level and push Maduro out. We definitely can't assume that Maduro would leave. A lot of the people at the top of the Socialist Party will not go down without a fight. So Maduro, crucially, still maintains the support of his two major international backers, Russia and China. And that is, of course, worrying because it brings with it the possibility that a regional crisis could snowball into a global crisis with the US, Russia and China facing off. There is now a long list of countries in Latin America and around the world that have thrown their weight behind Juan Guaido, but the crucial international backer is, of course, Donald Trump in the White House. Administration officials say it was to stop the Chavista looting of Venezuelan resources and to bring an end to this humanitarian crisis. But of course, the US has huge interest in Venezuelan oil. Geopolitically, it's worried about Chinese and Russian presence in the region. Immigration absolutely plays a role. We've had nearly 10% of Venezuela's population flee over the last few years, but the US will be very worried about Venezuelans starting to join the exodus north. I think it's very easy for pundits around the world who are not in Venezuela to brand this a gringo empire coup. But perhaps this is a case of, yes, Jair Bolsonaro and Donald Trump are not benevolent, pro-human rights, pro-democracy saints, but perhaps, just perhaps, they are the wrong guys doing the right thing for the wrong reasons. And when you go to Venezuela and you see this complete state of collapse that the country is currently in, it's really hard to turn around and say to those people, you don't have the right to change.
You can read more of Tom Phillips's reporting and follow events in Venezuela at theguardian.com. That's it for today. Thanks to Harriet Sherwood, to Tom and to David, and to Tom Phillips. Today's programme was produced by Rachel Humphreys, and the sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The execs are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll see you next week.